You are listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Mark Campanale. This podcast is supported by the Yan Michalski Foundation.
So you're founder of Carbon Tracker, and can you just explain for our listeners, you know, what it does and why it's crucial in today's environmental landscape?
So Carbon Tracker, we're a non-profit financial think tank focused on climate change and the energy transition. I set it up because I spent 20 years working in the financial world, and I noticed that a lot of coal and oil and gas projects, even with all the evidence that we know of climate change, they were getting financed through the banks and through the stock markets. And it was almost as if investors were completely disregarding what climate change was going to do within our lifetime. And so what I wanted to do was challenge them and challenge the way people think and challenge the financial operators, the bankers and the stock exchange regulators and the investors to think about what climate change was going to do and what we could do about it. But what we track is the financial flows going into fossil fuels. We analyze these big new projects, whether it's up in the Arctic or in deep water, where people are trying to do more fossil fuels. And we're going to the owners. That's what we're doing. We're saying to the owners of these companies, the shareholders, why are you letting these management teams, why are you letting these companies do this? When if you're running a pension scheme, you know, you're paying people's benefits. In 50 years' time, somebody who's 20 joins a pension fund, but they won't get paid for 50 years. Why don't you think about what the world will look like in 50 years' time? And why are you putting these young people's pensions into coal, which we know is destroying the planet?
So when you're presenting to these pension funds, but when we have examples like with the second Trump presidency saying almost do nothing, let's just go back to business as usual, even though renewable energy is by far more competitive when implemented intelligently, what kind of message has that sent? How does that reverberate around the world in terms of people who just want to turn a blind eye?
Well, I have to say, I look at this through a political lens, a geopolitical lens. So in one part of the world, you've got America, the world's biggest exporter of oil and gas today. And you've got 80% of the world's population lives in energy importing countries. So America is doing very well, selling its oil to other countries in the petrodollar. They like the fact that countries are dependent on their gas or their oil. And then the bankers like it. Every time they finance a project or they lease you a tanker, or they have a trading desk that trades in oil and gas futures. They're turning over billions of dollars every day in trading oil and gas futures. It's a money-making machine for them. Now, on the other side, you've got China, which has come in and is electrifying the world with super cheap solar, very cheap electric vehicles. And what is China doing? Well, of course, they're interested in climate change, more so than many other countries. And they know they need to shift away from burning coal, and they are. But what they're really doing is taking away the economic power of the United States by removing dependency on fossil fuels and creating independence. So countries are becoming energy independent by reusing renewable energy. And you can buy an electric car, the Seagull, from BYD in China for $7,500, which is an extraordinary low price. You can't buy an internal combustion engine car for $7,500. We now got super cheap electric vehicles and solar. So it's a kind of a geopolitical attack on the petrodollar. So many countries in the global south may be linked to America in some way, or the Western political system and economic system. Along comes the Chinese, and they're disrupting all of that. And in Europe, we've tried to protect our car industry, which is based on the internal combustion engine. We've given China a 10-year head start to produce cheap cars whilst we were fighting yesterday's battle. And so that's how I see it. It's a geopolitical thing. I think investors know that the European car industry, as we know it, is in rapid decline, and that America is in a sort of trying to put up the defense to keep people using fossil fuels. But the imperative of the climate emergency must mean we switch to renewables. There are some brilliant technology companies in Europe and America, of course, in climate technology. But China is dominating because they've got the intellectual property, cheap manufacturing, they've got the critical minerals. They've got light years ahead in mass production for super cheap products. We're living in a fascinating time. And unfortunately, to an extent, Europe and very much so North America are trying to hold on to the past, and other parts of the world, China, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, they're looking to the future. And I feel that we've rather left ourselves behind and that others take a leap forward. So this isn't just about climate science. It's about big geopolitics. It's about who wins the power battle over the dominant economy and economic thinking, and things like currencies, and do we have a reserve currency in the petrodollar? I mean, all these things are now being questioned in 2025. It's an extraordinary period of history.
So you mentioned the example of China there, and of course, with being the world's first electrostate, there's lessons we can learn. Obviously, now the real thing is to make sure that all that electricity is derived not from fossil fuels, not from coal. But what can we learn from that? Because I understand, on the other hand, America's not wishing to be dependent on some of the battery technologies that could be coming out of China. They need to make their own. So what can we learn from it? How can we also be more dependent and make our own batteries and all these other elements so that we're, as you say, it's a geopolitical question?
It is. Well, there are many different types of batteries, each with a different element in it that is the main sort of center of the battery technology. The chemistries are changing and people are getting better all the time about working out what works or what doesn't work. China does control a lot of the critical mineral marketplace supply, production, processing. And there's a shortage of magnets and other things because the Chinese are stopping exporting, I think. It's a difficult time in the manufacturing industry if you need rare earths metals. So we need to look at all of the chemistry available to us. Sodium, salt is not too far away from your lithiums on the chemistry table. So we could be finding different chemistries that work for batteries that are common. The evolution of battery chemistry in the last 10 years has been absolutely extraordinary. And there's going to be more innovation to come. Just look at the latest Chinese batteries that can charge in 5 minutes and run for 500 kilometers. I mean, this is extraordinary. So I think we'll see more. But I don't like a situation where one part of the world will dominate in a technology at the expense of the other. That just leads to disruption. What we need is common materials available to all, so long as we find the materials that really work to do the job.
And I was seeing there that we've seen a lot of turmoil or upheaval within universities in America. And I guess that there's a ranking of scientific universities around the world. And Harvard is still at the top. And then the other top 10, they're all in China. It doesn't make any sense to me. If you're talking about being independent and attracting the best minds, I thought that was very illuminating. So it's no mystery, perhaps, that they've become the first electrostate and are pushing for these things, for looking for alternative batteries or being less energy dependent or materials dependent on different nations. We have to support our universities. We have to support our intellectuals, our scientists. We can't have this level of transition without them.
Yeah, China is producing millions of qualified students each year in technology. And in Europe, it's measured in the tens, if we're lucky, hundreds of thousands. I mean, when you're producing that many highly qualified scientists and technologists, you can see how the collective brain power can see a big leap forward. There is a uniqueness to the universities in America, in Europe, whether it's Oxford, Cambridge, MIT, Harvard. The key to it is a discipline of freedom of thought and exploration of ideas, whether in science or the social sciences. That is the emblem or the symbol of a truly evolved society. You could probably argue that the world needs more scientists and technologists than it needs social scientists. But occasionally you throw up individuals that look at the world in a slightly different way.
I mean, yeah, I think it's sad that people say that we don't need as many people from the social sciences. But I do think to have movements, which is actually about accelerating the change, that we have to, of course, involve all the stakeholders, and you know, only a sliver of them are scientists and a sliver of them are.
Yeah. The way I think about it, I think a lot about where does power sit. In the traditional kind of lexicon, it's the power is in government and policymaker, which is true, and in the voter, the consumer. And then you've got this other body called business. So where does finance fit? The way I see it, it's business and finance are not the same discipline. It's a different community that thinks differently and acts differently. On one side, you've got business, and very often the other side, you've got finance. They're not always on the same side. And if you're interested in movements and power, people think of citizens' movements, which, of course, is fine. We should have an open and democratic society. But I think of power caucuses and power concentrations in the world of finance. And they know what their power is very well. I went into finance because I was interested in business, but interested in creating socially and sustainable businesses. That's what I've always done in 35 years. And social change movements in the context of people taking back control of their money. But I'm also interested in how you mobilize blocks of power to make change happen in society. The old joke about capitalism is that the workers took control of capital 20 years ago, but nobody ever told them because they took control through their pension funds. These pension funds are workers' pension funds. the workers invest their pension funds in companies. And these are the same companies that treat employees badly or don't pay them fairly or have exploitative practices. And so the correction to that problem is progressive funds representing workers, enforcing a particular view of the world through how they invest their money. And good examples of this are the Danish pension fund system, the big funds like PGGM and APG in the Netherlands, and CalPERS and CalSTRS, and the New York City pension scheme in America. And in the UK, we've got the People's Pension Fund, and we've got NEST, which is the National Savings Scheme, which are really trying to be reflective of the ordinary citizens' views about the world. And you'll see a very progressive approach to the people looking after these pension funds that tries to listen to people's needs. This tries to turn capitalism on its head. It tries to put people and their interests, whether they're working for a company or they're a retiree part of a pension fund, they're trying to sort of say, you too can mold your society. If you can build a movement of people's capital in the way that you can build a movement of political power, then you can have a different way of molding society.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.